the duckling. But if you haven't finished, I didn't mean to send him away. Where is he going? That lovely baby. But in the interest of the schedule, I would like to start now with your permission. And if you're still eating, please do quietly. I don't usually like that, but that's perfectly okay because you've got a 3 o'clock bus departure, those of you who are going, and you've got packing and stuff. And so let me do this summary closing up now. And I have begun by writing a short paragraph or two in a certain style, which I like. And I would like you to listen to it. And I know you'll be a bit quizzical, and it'll sound a bit strange, but you'll catch on very quickly. Oh, I need my glasses. And it came to pass, after the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed, and the mountain in the south was conquered, and Akiba was flayed in Caesarea, that the chosen of the Lord were scattered over the waters and the continents of the whole earth. And they lived among many peoples for many centuries, so that no man really knew what would be their fate. God was silent, and there was no prophet who heard his voice, so there was no message nor help. The people whom he had brought out millennia before carefully celebrated the exodus from Egypt, but they were uncertain whether the Brit still existed. 20 long centuries after the temple burned, there were other fires on earth, strange fires, such as those glowing in the belly of the idol Moloch who swallowed live babies. Strange fires which turned into ash the millions trapped by the vile, unspeakable evil which was not resisted until it was too late. And after these fires died down and the winds blew away the ash, God was still silent, and his people were silent in their sorrow and shock, for they could not understand why they had been so punished. Then suddenly there came a great thunder, louder than had ever been heard upon the earth since it was created, accompanied by a huge, colossal cloud that seemed to climb to heaven itself, and staggering waves of shock which tore down buildings, and scalding rays and steam and stones and glass rained down upon the people who died in their multitudes in their places. It seemed as though a mysterious curse was now unleashed upon mankind for the unspeakable crime against God's people. Somehow that people summoned its will, breathed strength into its sinews, charged its heart with courage, and gathered itself to its land once again to renew the covenant with its rock and destiny. The songbirds perched on the trees bearing fruit as sturdy men and women repopulated the waste places, tended the flocks, and planted the grain. The enemies came, as did drought and locusts and hot desert winds. But slowly, year after year, the land flourished, and the people taught their children that even though God was still silent, nonetheless, he seemed to be sending a message through the very land itself, which nourished the people into renewed strength and sovereignty. Thus endeth the tale of the wanderings in the diaspora and the Holocaust and the atomic explosion and the return. And thus begins the story of the new era now centered for the first time in two places, the ancient land, holiest of all places, as well as the new utopia across the seas. That brings us to where we are today. The Institute theme is called The Problematics of Nationhood, an analysis of some major issues challenging Israel's development. Maybe you never saw the theme of the Institute written down anywhere, but that's it. The Problematics of Nationhood. And so what did we do during this Institute? Well, we studied Joshua. That's what the beginners group did, Joshua and Jerusalem. We chased Saul and David. That's what the advanced group did. Purpose of that whole thing was to underline the basic position of the Bible as the bedrock of Jewish knowledge. So that's one thing we did. We settled into our heads the fact that anything you want to know about the Jewish heritage has to begin somewhere, and it begins with the Bible. The second thing we did was we studied some Hebrew. And we did that to underscore the importance of your learning it. And I would like to beg you that each person in his own city, at his own initiative, singly or in groups, continue to study Hebrew. Hebrew's a link between you and your past and your future. It's not easy. It's hard. It takes 1.5 hour every day, day after day, month after month, year after year, and some number of years down the road. All those 1.5 hours will add up. And you will have a vocabulary of several thousand words. So you can go to Charlie's restaurant and you can buy something in the store, and you can also maybe even read a text. The third thing we did was to study some text every day related to issues, but that doesn't matter, either on its own or related to issues, perfectly okay, but it's to get you into the habit. I would like to suggest you take that gray book, that you reread those texts, and always use that system with anybody who alleges to be teaching you. Whomever you take to teach you, make sure that that person just doesn't give you second-hand and third-hand and fourth-hand opinions. Make him read some original texts with you. It's a good habit to get into. And that's why we did it here in this. So we did three things. We set the Bible as the bedrock. We try to emphasize the importance of the Hebrew to you a la long. And we try to say, study out of texts. Well, the fourth thing we did was we made some trips. We went to the West Bank. We saw two towns there, one in Ephrat, close to Jerusalem, one in Ariel, far away from anywhere, out in the middle. They were chosen, among other reasons, and there were many, but for those reasons, to show you that there, when one talks about West Bank, there are two parts of it, really. One part is what's around the city of Jerusalem. There's a new phrase I learned in Hebrew, ibui, ibui shel ha'il. Ibui means thickening, the thickening of the city. Jerusalem has grown thicker on three sides of it in a great arc of a semicircle, pushing out into the West Bank 5, 6, 7 kilometers. I don't know how many kilometers Ephrat is to the south. 12, okay. And how many kilometers Neve Yaakov is to the north, and Maale Adumim to the east. That's about 10 or 12 also. So Jerusalem is thickened, and you can well understand that in the ultimate settlement of where the boundaries will be and the Palestinian state will be and all of that, Ephrat will be inside of Jerusalem. Ariel will not be. It's a second type of place. It's out there, and its fate and future is going to be different. So we made those those forays into the West Bank to show it to you physically. We went into two Arab-Israeli towns and wanted to put in front of you the problem of whether you thought there was discrimination against them. One man said that he's got 6,000 people living in the town, and in God knows how many years, nobody has issued him a building license. So everybody, every building that's built there is a crime, and the people who built it are criminals. And if the state of Israel, through the Minister of the Interior, wants to come in with a bulldozer and knock down all the houses that have been built illegally, the state of Israel can do that to its own citizens. Somebody told me that Shaare Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem doesn't have a building permit. Getting a building permit in this country is one of the weird facts of bureaucratic manipulation. Do you think that those Israeli Arabs are loyal to the state of Israel? Do you think they're treated badly? Do you think they're treated fairly? Do they take their citizenship seriously, even while at the same time they are sympathetic to their Palestinian cousins who live nearby, fellow Arabs? We took you there to put all those problems in front of you, to see the physical circumstances. You listened to three powerful Arab mayors and one Arab member of the Knesset, and those other guys are going to get into the Knesset too shortly, because they're going to consolidate into one large Arab party. They haven't done it ever yet. We took you to the law school to get bored out of your skull with that comment. But the purpose of that was, to indicate to you that the fact of a written constitution has now come up into the consciousness of the people. It's now a matter of public consciousness. And as the Justice Barak said the other day, it doesn't matter whether this particular version, this draft, gets passed or doesn't get passed. A version is constantly going to be up for passage from now on. The issues are too severe to be left to oral determination. I mean, everything converged: women's rights and civil rights and religious rights. And after a while, it became clear to everybody that you have to sit down and you can't just take the basic laws of the Knesset and stitch them all together. There are 8. There will be 2 more. You'll have 10. Stitch together the 10 basic laws, and you still haven't got a congenial and homogeneous constitution on which then you can fight for the next 200 years. And one set of judges will do some yes, and one set of judges will say no, and on it'll go from Marbury, Madison to who knows where. You'll have the same thing here, but that makes for stability. So really, all I wanted to know, all we want to do is show you that that exists, the people are now thinking about it, and you were in on the ground floor, so whatever year from now a constitution gets passed, you can say, chalk one up for me, I was there. In addition to, then suddenly you see your version of the story is going to get to be completely different. You won't say, oh God, was I bored out of my head. You're going to say, that was a very exciting day, because I heard so-and-so. Yeah, right. That's human nature, isn't it? Beside going out to see these things, we had you talk with a lot of people and had you listen to a lot of people. And you listened to everything from, I guess the farthest left we had was Amos Eilon, and the farthest right we had was Waldman. You met an awful lot of people, and you heard an awful lot of opinions, and your faculty gave you a lot of opinions, never mind the speakers who came in. I mean, you know, when you add together Simon and Pelley and you know, and Riskin and on and on and on, and I don't mean to eliminate anybody. But you had a powerful bunch of people talking to you with a big shade of opinion in there, and you had a chance to hear everything. Now, the main question is Judea-Samaria. That's the main problem. It's emotional as well as complex. The Israelis are going to have to decide about it in the next three and a half months. The election is the first week in November, same week as the one in the United States. So this is the middle of July, August, September, October, 3 months, that's it. And I would like to suggest that you have to decide it also. Decide, that is, where, what you think in your own head. And so what I've tried to do is put the problem into some sort of a rubric for the sake of helping you to decide. Now, you can come over and copy this later. Felicia wrote it on the board. If you start with the question, shall we agree to a Palestinian state or not? Or not shall we, should we, should there be a Palestinian state or not? If that's the way you frame it, and then if you'll see how I've added in all the factors, you'll see that I've tried to include all the basic things. If not, if you say no, there should not be a Palestinian state, no, under no circumstances, Landau, no, 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 then what are the consequences of that? Just let's see what they are. Number one, the consequences are a continuation of the military occupation. Number two, a continuation of the Intifada, possibly in escalated form. After a while, it's no particular fun to throw stones. After a while, it gets to be more fun to blow up a bridge, blow up a power plant. Number three, expansion of Jewish settlements as funds are available. I'd like to make it perfectly clear that nobody knows the exact amount of money that it took to build Ariel. But it was in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And the individual settlers who went there did indeed pay some money for the house in which they're living. Of course they did. But the price they were charged is not an economic price. It's much less. And there's a vast subsidy of government money into that place, all those factory buildings. So that as funds are available, and by the way, in parenthesis, they have not been for the past year or year and a half. The Lavi had to be canceled as a project, for one of the reasons was money. And so there was not much expansion of the settlements in the past year and a half. But as the economy recovers from the little bit of a slump that it's in now because the tourism is down and et cetera, let's not go into the details. As funds are available, and if the military occupation continues, then you can believe that there's going to be more money poured into the settlements. Because that's a political decision. And the Likud is making an assumption that it will take the election in November. And if it does, then of course it will try to find money somewhere and keep pushing it in. Number four, all of this leads to creeping annexation. And I'd like to make the point very clear that no one need worry about legal annexation. Nobody in this country, neither side, neither party, except very, very far right, Waldman, said, I would like to annex the West Bank. But as mainline Likud, will never put in a bill to annex the West Bank. Annexation carries with it such a complicated headache. of legalities and economic consequences and international consequences, and you don't need to do it because what you are doing today is creeping annexation. You're achieving the same results without paying the penalty of making a tough legal decision. So you don't do it. So creeping annexation will go on. The maintenance of two sets of laws in the territory will continue. You remember what Barak explained to you. Be sure you keep that in your head. Palestinians in the West Bank are administered under the old British and mandatory and emergency regulations. Jews living in the West Bank are administered under Israeli law. So you have one law for the Jews, you have one law for the Arabs, and that sets up all kinds of inequalities and all kinds of complications, but it's been going on for 21 years, so a lot of bureaucrats got used to it and got adept at it, so that'll continue. Number six, there will, of course, be an expansion of the Arab population. That's inevitable. That'll become part of the Intifada. I don't know which is more damaging, blow up a bridge or get the whole population working like mad to produce another 500,000 people. A perfectly legitimate strategic or tactical objective. Because then that will make, in number seven, that will make the demographic problem all the more exacerbated. Demography, democracy, and Jewish character of Israel will all demand a decision. So if you don't want to make the decision now, if you say, no, 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 I do not want to agree that there must be a Palestinian state. Don't talk to me about morals. Don't talk to me about ethics. My answer is no. Then these are the consequences. And number seven consequence is you're going to have to make the decision later if you don't want to make it now. There is no way in the world you can avoid making the decision forever. You cannot. You don't want to make it now. All of these circumstances, the demography, your feeling that the democracy is disappearing, you are feeling that the Jewish character of the state is going to get eroded and eaten away at. All of these are going to demand a decision sooner or later, and later if not sooner, because of a very simple thing. This status quo of being there as a military occupier simply cannot be permanent. It cannot be. It's a temporary thing, and you've kept it going for 21 years, and if you want to try to keep it going for 21 more years, you will find that at a certain point, you just cannot keep it up. And by the time you then decide that maybe you have to do something about it, there are those of us who think that Israel will be in a much worse position. But at any rate, regardless of what you think, No, there's no doubt in my mind that something which is status quo is not permanent, can't be. History doesn't permit it. Now go the other way. If you say, yes, I do believe that let's settle it, we'll have a Palestinian state, get it over with. If yes, then the consequences are as follows. Number one, Israel had better decide some policies fast. And I'll give you a few examples. That's all I mean by a few, because I'm not trying to be definitive in this list. I don't have the time, you don't have the time, and the board isn't big enough. Before going into negotiations, Israel's got to decide some basic things, among which are the following. What about our security matters? Demilitarization? Keeping the radar up on the high ground? So we can detect infractions, setting the boundaries. We have to do this internally. These are internal decisions that we have to make before we go into negotiations. What are the rights of Jewish settlers who want to remain there? We have to decide that. Is part of the negotiations, do we want to say, listen, Mr. Arafat or whoever, we believe that if there are Jews who want to live in your Palestinian state, they have to have a right to do so. Now let's figure out what their status ought to be, and we think that their status ought to be kach v'kach. I think the best solution, for instance, is they must have the right of permanent settlers. They shall remain Israeli citizens, living in the state of Palestine, with the rights of permanent residents. That's all they are. They're not going to vote in your Palestinian elections. They're not going to pay taxes to your Palestinian government. They are Israeli citizens. They'll vote in Israeli elections. They'll pay taxes to Israel. But they're permanent residents. You know how many people in the world fight like mad to get the status of permanent resident in Switzerland, for example? You can't get to be a Swiss citizen. I mean, you can put $20 million in front of, well, $2 million in front of a, in front of the president of Switzerland, you can't get Swiss citizenship. But you can get the right, become a permanent resident of Switzerland, so you can buy a house there. You don't know how tough it is to buy a house in Switzerland. Take the rights of permanent citizens, permanent residents. So any Jew who stays there, a permanent resident, if he wants to, takes his chances. You're not going to keep the Israeli army there to protect him. The Palestinian police have to protect him from Palestinian crooks and Palestinian thugs and Palestinian vandals. On the other hand, if he doesn't want to stay there, then the sale of evacuated properties of those who wish to leave has to be organized. I was saying to somebody at the table, I can't think of anything more incredibly wasteful, stupid, and unnecessary than Begin's agreement to blow up the town of Yamit when he left Sinai. My God. I mean, I don't know what kind of a Jew he is, but I can't think of any Jew who, if he could blow something up or sell it, would rather blow it up. Sell it! You don't think Egypt would have bought it? You don't think America would have loaned money to Egypt to buy it? What are we talking about? Little seichel, little common sense. Settlers who wish to remain, remain. Settlers who wish to leave, leave. An arrangement has to be made by which they can get their money back and by which the state of Israel can get its money back for what was invested in there. Well, as I said, I haven't made up a definitive list, but it's clear, you can see what I'm driving at, that if we decide yes, then these things have to be decided first before we go into negotiations, and then after we go into negotiations, after we go in, we have to decide, no, not, I'm sorry, again, before we go in, we have to decide with whom we want to meet. And we better not try to be smart alecky. There are 13 towns in the West Bank. You met three of the mayors. Say we will meet with all 13 mayors. And don't ask the guy to take out his wallet and show you whether he's got a PLO membership card in his wallet or not. You can believe he has. But you don't have to ask him and you don't have to know. I mean, this is nonsense. If you're going to talk to, you got to talk to the Palestinians. And on the other hand, you can have any number of people there as guests, as witnesses. I mean, this chauvinism which says, well, we have to meet here on Israeli soil. Where was Camp David signed? Washington, D.C. Israel went to Washington. Egypt went to Washington. Who was the witness? Was the President of the United States? You know. When your kid gets married to somebody else's kid, you know what a hassle it is to decide where the wedding's going to be. So it doesn't matter where the wedding is. And you can have the big powers or the little powers or no powers or bring anybody you want as witnesses to the wedding. Oh, that's good. Finished. Oh. Oh, there's a lot to be filled in, Pinchas. Fine. Listen, if they want to deal, sure, we put that down. Change Article 19 or 29, I forget which one it is. Got to wipe that out, fellas. That doesn't go. That's pornographic. You know, that's obscene to talk about destroying the state of Israel. Sure, agreed. I said it's not a definitive thing. And I would like to say that whichever way we decide, we have to know that there's a list of consequences. So that all I've done is given you a model. You sit down and you make up yourself in your own mind what you think the consequences will be. If we say, no, we don't want to do it, or if we say, yeah, we're willing to do it. Now, once we make up our own mind, and I keep talking about that from this point of view, because what I cannot understand is always worrying about the other fellow's state of mind and always wondering about what he's going to do to you, I would like just to finish this point by saying very simply, Israel is the fourth strongest military power in the world, not relatively, absolutely. America, Russia, China, Israel. Now that's an incredible league for us to be playing in, but that's where we are. So all this talk, which comes from my point of view, from weakness, is so bizarre because we are in the possession of enormous power. We lead from strength if we think that way, not from weakness. And I don't fear an anti-Semite behind every bush, that's just me. And I don't worry about what terrorists can do. They can, and I hope you will not misunderstand me, they can kill individual Jews, and that's a tragedy, but no terrorism can destroy the state of Israel. Terrorism can hurt individuals. It cannot destroy the state. And when people talk about security, I think about the security of the whole. Now, you may say, well, that's very cold-blooded as far as the individuals are concerned, and my answer to that is war, and people are going to get killed, and terrorism is a form of war. But terrorists, unless, you know, Libya wants to hand out atom bombs in little satchels, terrorists aren't going to have any way of harming the security of the whole nation. So I'm not... I don't even want to deal with that subject. I would like to go on to my next to the last point, the question of speaking out. Speaking out. I have just three things I'd like to say. Number one, dissent is not disloyalty. Never, never confuse the two. Now, how do you make sure that you don't confuse the two? First of all, get out of your head this funny thing that if you speak against some policy of the state of Israel, you're giving comfort to the Arabs or you're giving comfort to some congressman who wants to cut down on American aid to Israel or you're giving comfort to some non-Jew who loves to see Israel embarrassed. Do me a favor. Don't be afraid that you are weakening Israel by speaking out. I'll tell you a secret. 435 congressmen and 100 senators all know that there's a difference of opinion inside Israel on what to do, right? Therefore, they assume logically that there's a difference of opinion among Jews in the diaspora. And if they see some Jews expressing differences of opinion, you want to know something? They're not surprised. You are not revealing any secrets to them, and you are not jeopardizing the $3 billion in allocation. It's been made for fiscal 89, beginning October 1st, 1.8 plus 1.2, $3 billion. It'll shortly be made by about January or February when the new president gets into it for fiscal 90. Might be a little bit less if there are some economic problems. All right, so we knock off a couple hundred million dollars. America's got $14 billion to distribute around the whole world, and Israel gets three. Almost 20% of all the money that America gives to support everything all over the world comes to this little country. Incredible. So if somebody wants to take away a couple of hundred million dollars, do me a favor, don't call him an anti-Semite. It might be that he'd like to throw a couple of hundred million dollars into the food stamp program or something, or he'd like to give it to Fiji. It's also an ally of America. I mean, you know, it's a big world. The third thing I'd like to say about it is disagree with Israeli policies, even publicly, if you will. I find that okay, too, but under one circumstance. Don't say anything or don't do anything to defame Israel or to attack individual Israeli politicians by name. Those two things hurt. You can disagree with policies of a government, particular government in power, but you do not defame Israel nor Israeli politicians, because that's beyond the pale, that's the uncivilized conduct, that's the possible boring from within, destroying foundation of support and credibility. I have some quotations I would like to read to you. They're very quick. George Shultz. Too often, people become convinced that only their dreams or their causes are legitimate, and they deny the rights of others. Shultz said that the Arab-Israeli conflict was a competition between two national movements for sovereignty in one land, and he asserted that the conflict was not a fault of one party or the other. Both sides must lay aside prejudices, hatred, and overblown dreams in favor of a negotiated settlement. So using the word legitimate, Shultz reminds us of Benvenisti. There's a little bit of difference in their haircuts, not quite the same, but he is saying the same thing. Two, Ovadia Yosef, speaking at a meeting of the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, most of whose graduates are from Yeshiva University, said the other day, speaking on the subject, quote, territorial concessions in the light of halacha, close quote, stated his belief that saving a life takes precedence over the commandment of settling the land of Israel. In other words, just as one may call a doctor on Yom Kippur in order to save a life, so one may prevent the loss of life through war or civil unrest by giving up parts of Eretz Yisrael. Now, that's a former chief rabbi. That's a Sephardic chief rabbi who represents 65% of the population of this country, by far the majority. And he's saying, when you put it on a scale, if civil unrest is going to result in the taking of life, then to avoid that, you make your territorial concession. Well, okay. So once you think you got a real good quotation to lean on, the third one I want to give you is Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, the brother of the famous Joseph Soloveitchik from Boston, who tongue-lashed Orthodox leaders who were willing to make territorial concessions. So now, in order really to get confused more, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who's Joseph Soloveitchik's son-in-law, said to a group of Uri Simon and Avi Ravitsky's friends from Oz V'Shalom, Netivot Shalom, that in a negotiated settlement, it is inevitable that Israel must give up territory. Therefore, good friends, when it comes to quotations, you pay your nickel and take your choice. You can get one on this side, you can get one on that side, and I would therefore suggest to you that with all this disagreement among religious and political authorities, I can certainly understand the dilemma and the confusion of many of you. My really heartfelt advice to you is this. I've given you 3 months in which to make up your mind. I don't think you need that much, but supposing you take as much time as an Israeli and make believe you were voting in that election here in November, and how would you vote? Don't be discouraged by all the confusion. Keep searching, keep thinking, but come to a conclusion. That much at least you must do. Don't stall. Get off the fence. Weigh it, balance it, put everything into your scale that you want, and then get off the fence, decide. Because once you've decided, then you have a second obligation, which is to persuade others. That's the role of leadership. So if you're going to wait till the day before the election to decide, then you can't persuade others. Let's go back to the way we began. And it came to pass that after 40 years in the beautiful land of milk and honey, under their sovereignty, the children of Israel finally rested from the wars, gathered in their multitudes and their tribes, and prayed for a new Moses to lead them toward the future, which Isaiah had prophesied so many centuries earlier when he said that the lion would lie down with the lamb. The angel of the Lord then spoke. Through the clouds of confusion which had darkened the minds of the chiefs and the priests and the judges, the angel spoke in a clear voice so that every man and woman and child could hear and understand, saying, "The children of Isaac and the children of Ishmael are both the children of Abraham. They shall dwell side by side in the Holy Land, and no man shall lift his hand against another. Wise men shall sit at the gate and judge between them. When there's a quarrel or a case to be decided or an agreement to be reached, peace shall reign, peace with justice." And when the angel finished, the still small voice of God could be heard saying, "Amen." That's it. Thank you. And now, if you think you're done, you're not. Amy's got some things to say. And Nathan gave such lovely accolades in the earlier session to everybody. I would simply like to say my amen to them and to thank everyone who worked to put this whole thing together.
I'm also coming up here to give thanks and recognition. I'd like us all to give thanks and recognition to a few people who were really here for us to try to please us. First of all, our video and our audio teams, Tom and Scott, who are putting our experiences, saving this experience for us, and we'll all get a chance to see that. We'll be sending out tapes to the individual cities so that you'll be able to get copies of them. Also, Michael, our audio technician here. Whose hearing is fine. And Yaron, who was not here, but also helped out with the audio. And they took turns together. And then, last but not least, I'd like us to recognize the Dan Casaria Hotel, the management and staff of the hotel, who worked endlessly to please us. Where are they? They should be coming out here. Josh? Mike? David? Now, come on up. Come on up here. This is my right hand and my left hand. They really were.
We said in the beginning, when you came, can I speak Hebrew now? I think after 12 days. I'm in this hotel 6 years, and you are one of the finest groups that we ever had, really. We'll try to improve next time in the lunch boxes. But I think that the other things that people are taking granted in the United States for us are very difficult over here, and we were trying to do the best for you, really. And I hope to see you in the future as regular guest, or maybe as a Olech Hadash. And we would like to see you here again. Thank you very much for coming.